At the beginning, the first quarter of the 4th century, in the year 321 to be precise, the Emperor Constantine, the Roman Emperor, issues what's called the Edict of Milan, which grants religious freedom in the territories of the Roman Empire. And what that means is suddenly it's okay to be a Christian in the Roman Empire. Suddenly, to be a Christian doesn't mean to put your life daily at risk in the Roman Empire. And what that means then, it has an enormous impact on the church, because up until then, to be a Christian had been to be part of an underground movement that was just fighting to stay alive. And what that means, of course, what happens in those sort of movements is there are all sorts of kind of tensions and questions that actually don't ever get addressed, because all you're doing is concentrating on staying alive from day to day. But in 321, that situation changes, and suddenly Christians can come out into the daylight and openly say that they are Christians. And that means that various questions that before were never addressed have to be addressed. And one of the major questions is, who is Jesus? Do we believe as Christians that Jesus is really and truly God? Or is God so distant and so powerful and so important that he couldn't possibly come and share our life in a human way? And so for the whole of the 4th century, the church is sucked into what's called the Arian crisis. So Arius was a priest in Egypt who said that Jesus wasn't really God. He was like a super duper, really important, powerful angel, but he wasn't actually God. He was sort of the top of the tree in the heavenly hierarchy, but not actually God himself. And what happens after 321, of course, is that the Roman Emperor sides with Arius, because if there is one and one only God in heaven, means that there is one principle of power. But if Jesus is God as well, it means that there are two, at least, actually three, Father, Son, and Spirit, powers, three realities, which means power can be shared in heaven. Power isn't the exclusive possession of one person. And of course, if you are the Roman Empire emperor and you realize that God can share power in heaven, then power can be shared on earth as well. And if you are the Roman emperor, you do not want that, because that means your power might have to be shared with other people. So for the whole of the 4th century, the Roman emperor basically is pushing something that is against the Christian faith. But the Christians realized and understood from the very beginning that no, Jesus Christ absolutely was God himself. Christians are like, they're like Elvis fans, you know. If you go to an Elvis concert, you can go to an Elvis an Elvis imitator, like an Elvis tribute night. And it's a bit like going to an Elvis concert, because the guy has all the costumes and he looks like Elvis and he sings a bit like Elvis. But it's not the same as actually seeing Elvis in the flesh. And Christians knew that when they saw Christ, they absolutely weren't seeing a God imitator or a God tribute act. They were seeing God in the flesh, really and truly God, absolutely in the person of Jesus Christ. And so they come up with this teaching, to this formula to protect that insight. It's called the hypostatic union. Hypostatic, big word, it just means personal. Comes from the Greek word meaning personal, and it means that in the person of Jesus Christ are united everything that makes God God and everything that makes us authentically human. In that one personal unity of Christ, everything that makes God God and everything that makes us human is present. Jesus Christ, true God and true man. And what that also means, and so this is the second teaching, is called the communicatio idiomata. And what that means is it means the union of idiosyncratic properties, okay? So it means that whatever you can say about God, you can say about the person of Jesus Christ, because he's truly God. And whatever you can say about us human beings, you can say about Jesus Christ, because he is truly human. So it would be as if Stephen Redgrave, the Olympic athlete, were to become Prime Minister. Everything you want to say about an Olympic athlete, you can now say, the Prime Minister of Great Britain has a gold medal. The Prime Minister of Great Britain can row very fast. The Prime Minister of Great Britain was at the 1984 Olympic Games, or whatever. You can say, and you can also say, the Olympic gold medalist is more important than the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So everything you can say about a prime minister, you can say about this Olympic gold medalist, and everything you can say about an Olympic athlete, you can say about the prime minister. It's called the communicatio idiomata, and that's what we mean when we talk about Christ. Everything you want to say about God, you can say about Christ, and everything you want to say about humanity, you can say about Christ. At which point, if you are sensible, you will be very bamboozled and very bored by this. And the church understands that. Outside of a theology classroom, no one is that interested in hypostatic unions and communicatio idiomata and all of that sort of thing. So what the church in her wisdom does is they encapsulate all of that theology in the year 451 at the Council of Ephesus in one phrase: Mary, Mother of God. Mary is the mother of the person Jesus Christ. She gives Jesus his humanity. But because in that one person of Jesus Christ, God is really and truly present, we can say that Mary is the mother of God. And of course, the church knows that us Catholics, we love Mary, because she's our mother as well. And so instead of making us learn lots of complicated theological formulas, it just gives us that way of talking about Mary, Mother of God, which says everything we need to know about the identity of her son, that he is truly human because he is the son of Mary, and that he is truly God because Mary is the mother of God. The whole of the church's theology is encapsulated in this title. But remember also that this is not just about dry academic theology. It is about a 16-year-old girl who said yes to God's plan, and whose life was put in danger because she was then an unmarried mother. And then when she had her child, it was in somewhere strange called Bethlehem. And then she was chased out of Bethlehem by Herod's forces and fled into Egypt. And then she had to return from Egypt. You know, and her whole life is one of fidelity to God's plan. Because she is generous, God is able to come to us through that woman, through Mary of Nazareth. And so the thing is that God comes to us through Mary, and God in Christ gives us Mary from the cross, so that through Mary we can come to Christ. That's the thing, you know, when Jesus gives John, who symbolizes all of the apostles, his mother, he says, behold your mother. He's saying to all of us, yes, she's my mother, but she's also your mother. I give you everything I have, even my mother. And we know that when we turn to Mary, Mary always takes us to her son, Jesus Christ, true God and true man. In fact, and I'll finish here, I promise, the last recorded words of Mary that we have in the scriptures, it's that episode, the wedding feast of Cana. And the last words we know Mary ever said, she turned to the servants and she said of her son, "Do whatever he tells you." Mary says to us on this feast day, "Do whatever my son tells you, because therein lies your happiness and lies your salvation, because my son is true God and true man."